Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Carter Wren has spent 50 years in the middle of North Carolina's biggest political battles, from Ronald Reagan's 1976 primary win to Senator Jesse Helms' controversial 30-year reign as Senator No. Wren worked with a Raleigh attorney named Tom Ellis to build a Republican machine in North Carolina and beyond. The engine of that machine was Helms, who Wren broke with in the early 90s. Before they parted, Wren was one of the architects of racially charged ads against Charlotte Mayor Harvey Gantt, as well as the 1984 Helms reelection campaign against Governor Jim Hunt, a race that Wren remembers as the nastiest campaign he ever participated in. More recently, Wren has devoted much of his time to an unusually convivial bipartisan assessment of politics, a blog with Democrat Gary Pierce, who was a consultant to Jim Hunt, including in that same 1984 race. Now, Wren has written a memoir. It's called The Trail of the Serpent, Stories from the Smoke-Filled Rooms of Politics. Carter Wren joins me today to discuss that book. Carter, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thank you.
So the epigraph in your book is a line from the 19th century Irish poet Thomas More. Why did you choose that for your title?
Well, the line in the poem is the flowers of Eden we will inherit, but the trail of the serpent is over them all. I can't think anything fits that better than politics. Because there's some blessings and there's some gifts, but there's always the trail of the serpent twisting through there.
And you write that you weren't a political junkie, but you had friends in college who were enamored with politics. So how did you go from politically disinterested to dropping out of school to work on campaigns?
Well, I loved history, and I studied a ton of history at Carolina. But I had three friends, two I went to high school with, who were very much involved with politics. One of them worked in Jesse's first campaign in 72. And in 74, one of my friends offered me a job working with Helms in politics, not on his Senate staff, but in politics. And I thought, you know, I've sort of had enough college. I'll take a break and then I'll come back and I'll finish and I'll go on to grad school. And I went and took the job, got into politics. And it's like the mafia, you never get out. And so, you know, 20 years later, I hadn't gone back to college.
How much did your political views align with those of Senator Helms at the time you first got into politics?
Pretty much. You know, I was, most of the people that I went to school with were fairly liberal, but I went in the other direction. I actually started out sort of more liberal and then became more conservative as I went along. So I didn't have any problem with the philosophy behind the politics. And the first campaigns I ever got into were Reagan's. Mm-hmm. And that was a really good fit.
Yeah, I was going to say, much of the story you tell obviously involves your work with Senator Helms, but the first part of this memoir recounts Ronald Reagan's surprise win in the 1976 Republican primary in North Carolina when he was challenging the incumbent, Gerald Ford. And that win spurred a dramatic convention in Kansas City. It's funny because we always say, oh, well, this convention, there could be fireworks. Well, Kansas City is one of the true examples of that actually happening. And that set the stage for Reagan, of course, to go on and run and win in 1980. Maybe you could share with the audience a little bit of why Helms first supported Reagan.
Well, first, I will say I think it had more to do with Tom Ellis than anything else. But what you've got to, what people don't know today, people have forgotten today. When we lost the Vietnam War, The main generation back then were all World War II veterans. They'd lived through World War II. They were familiar with Hitler. And first time I heard Reagan make a speech, he talked about the tap, tap, tapping of Neville Chamberlain's canes on the umbrella on the cobblestones of Munich. And when they saw us lose the Vietnam War, they were shocked and they were frightened. And that fear created a river of people. In politics, people like to think, I've got this ship on track, I'm running it, it's not them, it's something outside of them. And the loss of that war so shocked and frightened those World War II veterans, they thought, we've got a real problem, we've got to deal with it. They started looking for a leader that shared what they thought, and they found Reagan. And that was what put Reagan's campaign on track and eventually elected him president.
And North Carolina, was that the only state he won, or it was one of a handful of states he won?
Well, I think he lost five straight primaries. Mm-hmm. And then he won North Carolina because we did a different campaign from what his national people did. What I was just talking about the river of people and the fear of losing the Cold War, the national campaign chairman didn't understand that. He didn't see any of that. And so after he lost the first few primaries, we broke with him and went in our own direction. And it worked. So we then took it to other states. We went to Texas, California, and we tell them what we did and give them the ads we did. And some of them went in the same direction we did, some didn't. But he ended up winning about half the states. We had a close convention. He was like 50 points behind going into the convention, or 50 delegates behind.
Right. And as you mentioned, we were talking a little bit before we came on air. You go to that convention, it's a wild convention, but the thing that really sets the stage for Reagan's future success is serendipity. And what was that?
Well, it was a rare convention. It was the last really real convention that was contested. And we lost on the third night. And at that point, it was over. There was nothing more you could do. They were going to come back the next night, and Ford was going to make his acceptance speech, and that was going to be the end of it. And I was sitting on the convention floor the fourth night with Alex Castellanos, and he said, "Do you think Reagan can come back and run again in 4 years?" I said, "No, not at his age." And it shows what I knew. But when Ford finished his speech, Reagan was in the hall first time. He was sitting in a box up at the top. And Ford waves to him to come down, and it's a unity gesture. You know, it's not a love letter. It's let's be united. And Reagan smiles and waves back, but politely shakes his head. And Ford waves again, Reagan shakes his head again, and people start chanting for Reagan to come down. So he finally does. And when he does, they start chanting for him to speak. Now, this is none of this planned. Nobody knew this could happen. And Ford motions to the microphone, and Reagan steps to the microphone, and he gives a speech. And it was incredible. That speech, unplanned, unexpected, puts him on track to run for president in 1980 and get elected. I mean, it's a gift that fell out of a clear blue sky. And that's one of the things I tell about politics. It's not the people that plot and plan and maneuver. It's usually the unexpected that happens that changes politics.
That's the voice of Carter Wren. He is the author of the new memoir, The Tale of the Serpent. Now, the two Helms campaigns that you focus on are 1984 against Jim Hunt and 1990 against Harvey Gantt. the former Charlotte mayor. Let's begin with Helms Hunt. Jesse Helms started that race down 25 points, according to your own internal polling. Why was he so far behind, and what was your strategy for him to recover?
Well, Jesse was very popular. It was really that character. It wasn't so much that people didn't like his stance on the issues, but they didn't like how he behaved, how he acted. And he had a mean streak, no doubt about it. And so, you know, I remember the pollster sitting there if he took that poll, and he said, Tom Ellis, ask him, do they disagree with Jesse on the issues? You're telling me more people dislike Jesse than like him. Do they disagree with him on the issues? And Arthur said, no, it's like Elmer Gantry. It's not what he believes, it's what he says and how he does. And so Jesse was very unpopular individually. The pollster said he had never seen someone, he had only seen two people that unfavorable in the past. And what we set out to do initially, there's three kinds of elections. I don't like, and this is the one we see all the time today, didn't used to see it much, but I don't like either one. I'm going to vote for the one I dislike least. Now, when we had Hunt Helms, we had, I don't like Helms, I like Hunt. We vote for Hunt. We had to turn it into a double negative in that election where they didn't like Helms or Hunt. And so there was nothing positive much in there. You couldn't convince them. They knew Jesse'd been in Senate for 12 years. You couldn't change their minds. So we started trying to hammer Hunt. And we hammered him for a year on ideology, liberal versus conservative. It didn't work. People didn't see Hunt as liberal. Didn't buy that. And here again, unexpectedly, a gift fell out of the sky. We did an ad that had one line in it about, where do you stand, Jim? And the pollster came back and he sat down and he said to Tom Ellis, you've got to learn something new. This race is not about ideology. Only one line in that ad worked. Where do you stand, Jim? It's about character. And Hunt vacillated a lot. He got away with it. But from then on, the election was about character, and it got closer and closer and went back and forth a lot. But at the end, Helms eked out a victory because Reagan was getting 2/3 of the vote in North Carolina.
And at that point, Helms, as you mentioned, is a 2-term senator, and Hunt has been governor for 2 terms.
2 terms, yeah.
By that point, that's a very unusual circumstance to have heavyweights of that caliber squaring off.
It was pretty brutal. And actually, Hunt was elected lieutenant governor the same year Jesse was elected to the Senate. So they'd both been in office 12 years. And if it was the last time you saw an incumbent governor run against an incumbent senator, that was it. It was a huge race.
Maybe in 2026, but we can get to that later in the program, right?
Keep your fingers crossed. It would be entertaining.
entertaining campaigns and controversy, those are not strangers to Carter Wrenn in his career, and we are going to talk about a lot more of those campaigns and political adventures coming up next right here on Charlotte Talks when we continue our conversation about the Trail of the Serpent. Stay with us.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. My guest today is political strategist Carter Wrenn, a consultant to Republican Senator Jesse Helms and the man behind Ronald Reagan's surprise win in the Republican primary in North Carolina in 1976. Carter's new book is called The Trail of the Serpent. So, Carter, we were talking about that 1984 race. Jesse Helms goes on to win by 4 points over Hunt and then faces former Charlotte Mayor Harvey Gantt in 1990. Gantt was Charlotte's first black mayor. And during that campaign, you helped create an ad about affirmative action that came to be known as the White Hands ad. Here it is.
You needed that job, and you were the best qualified. But they had to give it to a minority because of a racial quota. Is that really fair? Harvey Gantt says it is. Gantt supports Ted Kennedy's racial quota law that makes the color of your skin more important than your qualifications. You'll vote on this issue next Tuesday. For racial quotas, Harvey Gantt. Against racial quotas, Jesse Helms.
Now, the ad included a white man crumpling up a rejection letter, and you write that the influence of this ad has been overstated, but that you later came to regret it. How so on both counts?
Well, let's start with the later came to regret it. After that campaign was over, I guess 7 or 8 years later, I became friends with a black Air Force sergeant who was retired, grew up in Raleigh, lived in Raleigh. And we'd see each other once a week, and he loved to tell stories. And he always told stories, usually about the Vietnam War. You know, he was in the Air Force during the Vietnam War. He's over there during the Da Nang fight and flew on planes that were over the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So finally, after a couple of years, one night we were sitting in my office talking, and he said, a friend told me you had something to do with that White Hands ad. And I thought, oh my Lord. And I said, I did. Earl Ashe and Alex Castellanos and I made that ad. And I said, what happened was Harvey Gantt attacked Jesse Helms for voting against Ted Kennedy's Civil Rights Act. And so Gantt started the fight, but that bill included racial quotas for hiring. So we did an ad that answered that attack. And I said, I didn't see anything wrong with it. A lot of people said it was racial, but I didn't see it as any kind of a racial smear. It was just answering an attack. And that was how I saw it. Now, missing fact in all this, back then when we put that ad on the air, we were polling every fourth night. We ran the ad for 4 days, polled. It didn't have any impact at all. Nobody cared about racial quotas. So we switched to another ad, but the press picked it up and ran with it. And when I was talking to the black guy in my office, he said, well, I see. The next day, he came back and he brought 4 Tuskegee Airmen with him. And they sat down in my office, and he smiled at me, and he said, Carter, these men served in the Air Force when they couldn't vote. He said, that's what I call patriotism. And I saw that ad through those men's eyes, and I thought that was wrong. Shouldn't have done it, wouldn't do it again. And in one sense, you could argue it wasn't racist, Jesse did, but you were playing to a racial fear. And the way those men lived in a racial world. And so that's why I think it was wrong to do that. It wasn't a political decision or anything else. It was just, when I saw it through their eyes, I thought it was wrong.
Have you ever discussed that ad with Harvey Gantt since then?
I've never seen Harvey. I don't think I've ever even met Harvey Gantt, to tell you the truth, but I haven't seen him since then. The way I felt about it became public. A reporter from, I forget who he was with, came to see me and wanted to do an interview. And he had talked to Jesse and asked him, you think that ad was racist? And Jesse said, oh no. And the guy asked me, did I think it was racist and would I do it again? I said, no, I wouldn't do that again. And I told him the story. And that was when it went out. But no, I've never talked to Harvey Gantt about it.
If you ran into him, what do you think you would say to him?
You know, I would be nice to him. And I wouldn't, as if he brought it up, I'd tell him, look, it was a mistake. I'm sorry it happened. But I think one thing you've lost out of politics is today it's all a cudgel match. And if I met Harvey Gantt, I would be nice and courteous to him. You know, it's like when I met Gary Pierce, who was one of Hunt's campaign leaders. There was ice in the room. It was just, I looked across the table and saw a devil. He looked back and saw a devil. 15 years later, we became friends. And we're still friends 22 years after that. So I think one thing that's bad about politics is the hatefulness in it today. People just love the, I don't know if this is social media or the internet, or if it's Trump, I don't know. But people just love the meanness of politics now.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about, you know, you mentioned in the book a couple times that Jesse Helms had a mean streak, demagoguery. There were things that you didn't agree with. And obviously, he had a national reputation for homophobia, for voting against civil rights, for a string of controversies. There are people who, or Democrats in particular, I think, who might draw a line from some of Jesse Helms' tactics straight to the language that you hear from Trump. Do you see a difference between those two?
I think that the it's a fair comparison and a fair line. I think the primary difference, if you go back to the 70s and the 80s, if a politician told a lie, he killed him. Nixon lied after Watergate, got caught on tape telling a lie. And even though he won in a landslide, he had to resign. That was in 1974. And that was about the time I started out in politics. After that, politicians were terrified of lies. No politician was going to tell a lie. And you saw that ethic held up for years. It's gone now. I mean, politicians lie all the day. Trump tells lies twice a day. And nobody seems, it doesn't seem to come home and haunt him. I think that's the big change. Helms, he had a mean streak. He'd punch, but he knew not to lie. And today, it's part of politics. You just go out there and tell a lie, and there it goes.
That's the voice of Carter Wrenn. He's the author of the new memoir, The Trail of the Serpent. Carter, we talked a little bit before we came on air about this, and I want you to maybe explain a little bit to the audience, because there are people who have been in North Carolina. Myself, I've been here for 30 years, so I at least was around when Jesse Helms was in office. There are many other people who have moved here, didn't grow up around here, or are just simply too young. But Jesse Helms was such a lightning rod. You know, I'm trying to think, maybe Nancy Pelosi is that to Republicans now, would be analogous. I mean, he was a national figure. But maybe you could just fill in some of the context of why Jesse Helms was such a lightning rod for so long.
Well, Helms ran the first time in 1972. And no Republican had been elected to the Senate in North Carolina in the 20th century at that point. All politics centered on the Democratic Party. And you had two tribes. You had the progressives and you had the conservatives. And in the late 50s and early 60s, the conservatives hardly ever won a statewide election. You had Beverly Lake versus Terry Sanford. Sanford won. So what happened in 72 was Tom Ellis told Jesse, we need to elect a conservative. Tom Ellis was the real ideologue of those two. And Jesse said, well, I don't think a conservative going to win a Democrat primary. And Ellis had run as a Republican. And Jesse thought that was a little crazy, but he did it. And that created an ideological shift. Conservative voters started voting for Republicans. So all of a sudden you had a largely progressive party and a largely conservative party, the Republicans. And that defined politics all the way through Reagan. It was conservatives and liberals. And that was really what started out with Jesse. Now, after he becomes an incumbent, it's a different world. I mean, he lives through the Cold War. Well, when the Berlin Wall fell, politics changed. It went from liberal conservative to sort of an evolution where it became more about characters and opportunities than it did ideology. But Helms actually entered into it from an ideological perspective. And that was what ruled politics under Reagan.
Jesse Helms, for context, was senator for 5 terms from North Carolina, 30 years, the longest in the history of the state, and eventually led the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, among other things, in the Senate. I want to ask you, you mentioned earlier your friendship with Gary Pierce, longtime Democratic strategist and aide to Governor Jim Hunt, who served a record 4 terms. In the book, you include Gary's assessment of political strategy, which is, quote, when you're in a campaign, you're really like a frog on a log floating down a river, watching the banks roll by, telling yourself, I've really got this log rolling. But it's not you, it's the river, end quote. What are a couple of examples of that from your career in politics?
You know, and it's sort of an old story of human vanity. You know, everybody likes to think, I've got this under control, I'm doing a great job, I'm winning, I'm successful. And most of the time has nothing to do with him. There are powers in the world a lot more powerful than men. And Reagan's speech in 1976 is an example. That wasn't some scheme some man came up with. Hey, we're going to do this and do that, and that'll work out, and we'll get Reagan elected in 4 years. It was just outside of men's control. It was a gift. Other examples of that, I remember when Gary told me that story, we were sitting in my office and I thought, boy, that's absolutely right. When Reagan's elected in 80, same story. It wasn't really anything, not to demean anybody, but it was about the Iran hostage crisis. I mean, that just shocked people so that they just moved in a direction they wanted somebody that would be stronger than Carter was. You go through the elections, the COVID during Trump and Biden. That really was the thing that decided the election. It was the COVID thing and people's reaction to, well, Trump doesn't know how to deal with it. So that's 3 examples of outside factors that can change campaigns and politics.
You write in the book about your childhood and coming up. You grew up in difficult circumstances. Your father physically abused your mother. Your mother was an alcoholic. You and your siblings were split up, and you ultimately went to live with your grandmother, who nurtured you and gave you a lot of things that you had not had before. How do you think your childhood shaped your political beliefs?
Oh, Lord. I think my grandmother had a lot of influence. She was just a good, decent person, and she wasn't what you would call a sweet grandmother. She was pretty head on. During the Depression, my grandfather was great at building things. My grandmother ran his company, his construction company. She was as much a part of making a success as he was. She made a lot of difference. And, I had a broken family, but my mother was a loving woman, and she really did try to do her best. She just had problems. And working with Tom Ellis was a blessing to me because he was such a stable, straightforward force that he was very easy for me to work with.
Now, you describe the aftermath of the very difficult birth of your first daughter. I want to read this to you. Quote, "It was still daylight when I walked out of the hospital. Staring up at the sky, climbing into my car, I thought, I handled that pretty well. Put the car in reverse, slammed into a concrete pillar." End
Yeah, I
quote.
did.
True
And
story?
true story. Looking back, it wasn't really as terrible a birth as I thought at the time. I mean, my wife cruised right along. But at the first, there was a problem with the umbilical cord. And a nurse came in and straightened it out pretty quickly. But that sort of sent me into a, oh my Lord, what's going on here? And I just never been through anything like that. So I called, a doctor I knew and another doctor I knew and had a bunch of people over there. Well, the page went through it. She had the daughter. Everything went fine. And when I walked out of the hospital, I thought, oh, you handle that pretty good. It's what I was talking about with, people think they control things. Got into my car, backed up, and slammed into a pillar and knocked the back end apart. It's a lesson about what vanity does to you.
Absolutely. We will be back with more tales of perhaps cars flying off the rails and other things right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we're continuing our conversation with political strategist Carter Wrenn. He has just published a memoir of his political life entitled The Trail of the Serpent. I want to ask you, Carter, you write that politics is a mean, vicious world. Even so, you mentioned earlier, it's like the mafia, you can't get out. Why did you stay in, though, knowing what you learned pretty early on?
Well, I was a conservative, and I believe that standing up for those ideas was right, and that was it for a long time. I still feel that way about it. And I like politics. It's interesting. Today, usually when I get in a campaign, it's a friend that I knew 15 years ago will call me and say, I'm running or my son is running. And would you help him? And I'll say, yeah, sure, I'd help him. But I think today the biggest reason to be in politics is to try to save it from itself. Back when I was younger, we talked about it a little bit earlier, lies were taboo. Today happens all the time. Insults were taboo. You could attack an opponent on an issue, but if you call him a scumbag, it blew up on you. And it's the boasting, I'm going to save you. That's a big change in politics since the 70s, 80s, even 90s. And I think that if we don't fix that, we're going to keep right on going downhill and we're going to get in a lot worse shape, because I think that reflects a decline in our whole country.
You, along those lines, you finished the book with thoughts on the current political era and Trump, who you are not a fan of. I want to hear your perspective on this aspect of Trump's success. In 2021, the North Carolina State Republican Party censured Senator Richard Burr for voting to convict former President Trump in the impeachment trial following January 6th. Burr called the censure, quote, a truly sad day for North Carolina Republicans, end quote. Last summer, he told an interviewer he planned to vote for Trump in 2024. How do you explain that?
Well, Trump, it's sort of what you call practical politics, which is part of the problem. Trump, he now has an iron grip on the Republican Party. I'm surprised. I didn't expect to see that. But there are a third of the Republicans that they believe in Trump. It's sort of like a, I don't know, he nods and they jump. And if you're somebody that's a Republican elected official in North Carolina, take our congressional districts. We've got 14 congressional districts. One of them is a swing district that is decided by a general election. I think three are Democrat decided by the primary, and the rest are Republican decided by the primary. If you're a Republican elected official in one of those Republican districts, you're terrified of Trump, because his grip on the Republican Party could cost you a primary. So you don't have many people in the Republican Party that are going to look Trump in the eye and say, you shouldn't have said that, or you shouldn't have done that. And that's what happened with Burr. In a Republican Party, you know, there's 7 million voters in North Carolina. There's maybe 7,000 people that go to Republican meetings. They're such a tiny piece. They don't reflect anything. But they are more devoted to Trump than any other group.
In November, as you know, Democrats won the governor's race. They won the lieutenant governor's race, attorney general, superintendent of education. In December, the state legislature this month, with Republican majorities, passed a bill to limit the powers of those offices, including making the state auditor the overseer of elections for the first time. What do you think? And this was very controversial. Anyone who's been in the state the last few weeks knows that. What did you think of those maneuvers?
Well, let's pick two pieces of that apart. Let's take the Democrats winning all the major statewide races while they lose the president. Now, what you had in my opinion, in the presidential race, all the Republicans went to Trump. All the Democrats went to Harris. The swing voters, the biggest group of voters who decide the election, they looked at Trump. They didn't like Trump. They looked at Harris. They didn't like her. So they had a Hobson's choice. Which one do I think will do the least harm? And at the end, I think largely because of inflation, they decided Trump. So he wins by 4 points. Mm-hmm. At the same time, in the governor's race, you've got Mark Robinson and Josh Stein. And Robinson is a Trumpster. Same style, same stands. You know, he's pretty tough. That ad that he did, that Stein did about him, where he says, abortions because a woman doesn't keep her skirt down. Now, I'm against abortion. I think it's wrong. I think it's taking an unborn life. But when I saw that, I thought he just insulted women. That was unnecessary. And I think that's how a lot of women saw it. So that when you got to Stein and Robinson, you had a lot of people that didn't like Robinson. And nobody disliked Stein. It wasn't that the independents agreed with him. It wasn't they thought he was a superhero. It's just, I got nothing against him, and that guy over there is mean and insults people. Robinson gets beat by 15 points. That's the difference, a double negative versus a positive versus a negative. I think that's a big part of it. And I think that the Democrats in the state, they deserve credit. They understood that. As far as the rest of it, you were asking about the changes in the election boards. And it's just power grabs. It's gone on for, you know, years. When the Democrats had control of the legislature, they did the same thing, and they didn't just do it to Republicans. When Republicans elected a governor and lieutenant governor, you know, the Democrat state Senate stripped the Republican lieutenant governor of his power. Hell, they'd do it to each other. So that kind of power grab's gone on for years. That's what's going on right now, and it's a shame. You should think Republicans condemned that for years, and then when they got power, they started doing the same thing. It's a bad situation. It's a mistake to point at the Republicans and say they're the only ones that did it. At the same time, it should stop. There should be an accountability for it.
That's the voice of Carter Wrenn. He's the author of the new book, The Trail of the Serpent. Carter, I wanted to ask you, I mentioned Lieutenant Governor, of course, that's Rachel Hunt.
Yeah.
She is the daughter of your old political rival, former Governor Jim Hunt. I'm wondering what similarities, if any, you see between them as political figures.
You know, I hardly know Rachel Hunt. I've seen her being interviewed a little bit at times. So I really don't know the answer to that. All I can really tell you is that Gary Pierce thinks she's a really good woman. Mm-hmm. And I like Gary, and I trust his judgment. But I really don't know a lot about Rachel Hunt.
We referenced
Jim Hunt's as far as I want to go into getting to know the Hunts.
There's all that political rivalry still in there. We mentioned earlier when we were talking about the Jim Hunt, Jesse Helms race, the rarity of having governor, sitting senator.
Yeah.
And there's all this speculation about 2026 and whether Tom Tillis, the incumbent, will face outgoing Governor Roy Cooper. Tell me what you think is likely to happen. Do you think Cooper will run? And if he does, what kind of campaign, what kind of race would you expect?
Roy would be a tough candidate to beat. You know, Roy is sort of maybe history may prove me wrong about this, but I think he's the last of the old Jim Hunt sort of Democrat. Grew up in a rural county in the eastern part of the state, understands that world. He's not radically liberal, sort of moderate, polite, easy to get along with. If you meet Roy, you like him. I think he'd be a real tough candidate for Tillis to beat, because Tillis is sort of your archetypical political guy. He was in the state legislature for years, then he was in Congress, and that sort of thing. I think Roy would be a powerful candidate if he wanted to run. Whether he will or not, I don't know.
As you well know, since 2010, Republicans have held majorities in both chambers of the state legislature. Court cases and gerrymandering are constants in the state of North Carolina. That's a little bit of a long way around the barn. Do you think there is any chance that Democrats will make any meaningful gains in either chamber of the legislature? They broke the supermajority, but still, they're nowhere near a majority.
Well, the in 1992, after Reagan was elected president, he had an off-year election. And at that point, I had been in the 76 race with Reagan, where we won the primary. 78 race with Hess, where we won the general election. 80 race with Reagan and John East, where we won. And I thought, oh, we've got this down. We win it again. I was pretty confident we were going to win in 82. Never seen an off-year election. And every candidate we supported for Congress lost. It was a devastating off-year election. And you see that. I saw it in 82. I saw it in 94, the Republicans' favor. You saw it in 2010 in the Republicans' favor. I think if you get a huge off-year election, that could flip it back the other way. Is that likely? We're pretty polarized today, but those independent voters, if something pushes them all one way, that could change it. And frankly, getting rid of redistricting, that would be one of the, getting the partisanship out of redistricting. I think that's one of the biggest changes we could make that we would benefit from, because a lot of the mess you see in politics today is a result of redistricting. Mm-hmm. If you made every politicians don't mold voters, they reflect them. Mm-hmm. And if you made every election competitive, then that would change how politicians behave. So I think redistricting is a much overlooked and important issue.
Which do you think will occur first? A Republican becomes governor of North Carolina, or a Democratic presidential nominee wins North Carolina?
More likely you get a Republican governor at some point, but you know, we're a swing state. You can go either way. We tilt a little bit to the Republicans because we're a southern swing state and we have a lot of rural voters. But you could flip a coin, depend on what happens in politics. And there again, it goes back to what I was talking about earlier. If there's a crisis, that'll change politics. If people go from, well, it's sort of a mess, but it doesn't really matter, to, we got a problem, we got to fix that. That's when they start putting all the mess aside and looking for a real leader. If that happens, then you can change it pretty quick.
That river you were talking about earlier.
That river, yes.
In the remaining few moments, I want to ask you a little bit about, you know, you worked on this book. I think you started during the pandemic, speaking of COVID-19. Yeah. Were there three or four political books that, you know, you had in mind as you approached this for yourself?
You know, I never saw a lot of political books that I thought were real good. All the King's Men, I thought that was phenomenal, about Louisiana politics. Mm-hmm. I thought, not sure I'm going to get this guy's name right, but there was a guy that, I think his name was Klein. He wrote a book about the Clinton campaign.
Mm-hmm. Joe Klein. Yeah.
I thought that was pretty good. I thought the more sort of esoteric books like, who was the guy that wrote a book about each presidential campaign every 4 years?
Theodore White.
His books were great, but they didn't really get into the dynamics of politics. And so I didn't see a lot of great political books that I liked. And the way I wrote this book, had a friend in New York, and when they had lockdowns up there, he started calling me, and he loved talking about politics, and we'd sit there and sell Tories. And finally he said, well, you got to put all those stories in a book and write a book. And that was why I started writing the book. That was it. Now, when I got into the book writing, I had to read a lot about Trump, because I don't know Trump personally. I know people that are close to Trump, but at any rate, we got the stories told, and there it is.
That's the last word. Carter Wren, author of The Trail of the Serpent, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.